I see this show in many ways as a celebration of the ways in which romance and sex and creativity and art and all these things maybe are even more heightened in a crisis, you know, and provide this, you know, ballast against despair.
Says Anna Winger, photographer, writer, screenwriter, and producer whose new series Transatlantic just dropped on Netflix worldwide. I have to say, I gobbled it up. I binge-watched because it is truly fascinating. For Weltkunst, it is also very fascinating because it has all these artists that appear. We will talk about those guys. But since our podcast is called Was macht die Kunst? What's happening in the arts? That would be my first question to you.
Well, I mean, I guess what's happening in my world of the arts is this TV series that I just made that is about a bunch of artists who were trying to get out of Europe in 1940. But I think the reason it was interesting for me was because it relates so much to things that are happening today, both in terms of surrealism making a comeback in the art world, but also politically.
The premise of the setting is the Emergency Rescue Committee, which led a young man named Varian Fry into Marseille in the early 1940s. And I've heard the name Varian Fry before because I knew he was connected somehow to arts and he was helping Jews and other people at risk flee from Nazi Europe. But how did you find this story?
Well, funnily enough, there's a street called Varian Freistrasse in Potsdamer Platz. I was walking with my father and he said, oh, you know, Varian Freistrasse, you know who Varian Fry was, and I didn't. And he told me the story about this young man from New Jersey. He was 32 at the time. He was a journalist. And he was sent over by a group of people in New York, most of whom were recent German emigres like Thomas Mann and Einstein, who were basically wanted to send someone over to try and find their friends and get them out. And he was sent over to Marseille in 1940 with a list of 200 names of people to find. Many of them were Jewish. Many of them were also blacklisted artists and writers who were not necessarily Jewish themselves. And once he arrived, he sort of gathered a whole team of people around him that he met there. And this is the Emergency Rescue Committee. And they eventually got more than 2,000 people out in the course of about 13 months.
So there are some, I mean, truly famous people among them, including Hannah Arendt, Walter Benjamin, who unfortunately didn't survive, played by Moritz Bleibtreu, by the way.
Yeah.
So you found this story and then you found the novel that was based on his life. And you, how did you go about, you wrote it and you co-produced this series for Netflix? How long did it take?
Well, there's always ideas that are percolating in my mind for a long time before I work on them, you know, intentionally. I think that walk with my father was probably in 2012. And I started to think about the story again during the period of time when so many refugees moved to Germany and specifically to Berlin, because, you know, we and everyone we knew were involved in helping within the refugee effort and resettling people. And my office, my company is called Airlift, and my office was originally located in the Tempelhof Airport. And the point of sort of first entry was actually in the hangar below my building. So we were volunteering to help people who were just arriving from, you know, who had come across the Mediterranean from, you know, in the circuitous route from Syria, how people were getting to Berlin. My daughter, who was 12 at the time, said to me, these people that we're meeting, they're just like us, except for that people like us had to leave Berlin and these people are coming here seeking refuge. And I was really moved by that idea, you know, the full circle of that and the fact that, you know, less than a century ago, people like ourselves, Jews, artists, had to leave Berlin and that people were now coming here seeking refuge was very moving. And it made me, I remembered this story at that time. So that was in 15, 16, that time. I started thinking that it would be interesting to research it further. The strange thing about this story is it's kind of the greatest story never told. Like there's actually, because everybody involved was a writer or an artist, there was a lot written about it, that people wrote memoirs, they wrote short stories, plays, novels. While I was making Unorthodox, a novel came out that was called The Flight Portfolio, written by an American writer named Julie Oringer, that I had already fictionalized it recently. And she, You know, novels are difficult to adapt because they're very cerebral, whereas, you know, they take place in someone's mind, a lot of them. And when you put it on screen, you know, you need to activate what's going on in their head. But what was useful for me about The Flight Portfolio was that it really got inside Varian's head, and it got inside the question of why would someone do this? What was it like to have this pressure on him? You know, and he chose the mission and what it was like to live through that mission. So I thought that was very moving. So I optioned the book, and I actually wrote the series during the pandemic. So, you know, in many ways, I think that the story itself serves as a metaphor for many things. You know, it's like, it's about one refugee crisis. I was inspired by another, and we ended up making the show during a third, of course, because the war in Ukraine started like our third day of production. In 1940, the south of France was the last free zone in Europe. Maybe everybody knows this, but, you know, things were not looking good. You know, the north of France, Germany, the east, Italy, Spain were all fascists. This is during the Blitz. And there was this one last free zone in Europe in the south of France. And so the characters, they're sitting in what anyone would describe as a paradise landscape. And but they're aware that there's extreme danger outside their door, but it's not visible. And I thought, you know, having written this during the pandemic, I think, you know, that also resonated with me. So for me, the project touched on just many things I was thinking about.
It's true. It's also this classical topic of having a kind of a beautiful garden that's like a paradise, and outside either the Black Death is raging or something is raging, and you have these just physically very attractive people. And then also what I found fascinating, of course, was how they passed their time and dressed up and had these crazy costumes, and you have Marcel Duchamp in drag. This is also something that causes maybe some unease while watching this, because the big contrast between the horrible fate of millions and then the few, maybe even happy hours of a few people. It's a very tough act to navigate.
To one degree, it's about how, you know, refugees are human beings and that find themselves stateless or find themselves victims of a political situation beyond their control, but they're still human beings, right? And so even if they're famous artists, they have to pass the time. There's sort of a hurry up and wait aspect to the story. And, you know, I would imagine that a lot of romances start when people are waiting around for something better to happen. To some degree, for me, this story is a celebration of the ways in which creativity and community and friendship and romance and even sex and like the salve in the crisis, you know, it's the light in the darkness, the thing that makes us remember that we're alive even when the shit is really hitting the fan. And I think what was incredible about this group of people who were truly unsuited to a crisis. I mean, they were not, you have to imagine that they had left Germany already in the early 30s and had gone to Paris and had to reacclimate to a new language, a new city, had settled there and felt that they were safe there. So the fall of Paris was a, you know, a terrible repetition for them. It was exhausting. You know, many of them had been imprisoned twice, first as Germans when France was fighting the Germans, and then as Jews once the Nazis took over in Paris. So it was a really bleak moment. At the same time, they were happened to be with friends. The thing that they do in order to pass the time, which is that they were doing collective artworks, these exquisite cadaver drawings that were like collective drawings they were making on folded pieces of paper. They made their own set of Jeux de Marseille, you know, these tarot cards. And they were sort of making art with whatever they had around, you know, found objects, sort of very rudimentary art materials. It's not like they had a lot of supplies. So
I would like to pick up this exquisite cadaver game, because that was popular with the surrealists since the 1920s.
Oh, no, they were also doing it with poems. There's a few scenes where they're doing it, they're making up stories and stuff like that, That game is, if you've ever played it, it's like Exquisite Corpse, but with words. And so each person writes down a different sentence, and then you read it together, and it sounds like a kind of surrealist poem. So they were making up, you know, they were just passing the time. And they often worked together on different pieces, right? They weren't like unique objects made by one artist. They were kind of collective artworks. And we thought that was really moving. but we also didn't want to copy anything. Actually, I thought it was kind of tacky to make copies of artwork. So instead of doing any copies or ascribing any particular piece of art to any particular artist, we had one artist live with us in Marseille during the production and make all the art in the show. So like everything was just made by a woman named Stephanie Snyder, who used to live in Berlin and now lives, she's a New York artist, she now is living in New York, but she spent the duration of the production with us and made all kinds of things for us. Like, you know, they have a sort of collective studio in one room where there's like a studio that everybody can use. And she made the artwork there. She made she started the whole project by making her own Jeu de Marseille, which we then reproduced as a gift for everybody, which
beautiful.
I brought you one.
Great.
And she made a lot of the decorations for the party. She collaborated a lot with our production designer, Zilke Fischer. So, yeah, I mean, in a way, there was something about making the show that replicated the experience that it describes.
And the costumes are also amazing. Yeah. Is that new invention or are there some Schiaparelli or other designs?
I mean, there was a lot of surrealist influenced fashion at the time. So we have just this incredible mood boards that were created by our costume designer, whose name is Justine Seymour. She made a lot of stuff by hand. I mean, all the hats and stuff in the party. She was making things out of paper and out of found object, but it was definitely inspired by all kinds of fashion, certainly Schiaparelli, but a lot of other things that were being made at the time as well.
I want to know more about the artists that appear in your series. There's Marcel Duchamp, there's the Chagalls, there's André Breton with his wife Jacqueline Lamba, Victor Brauner, Hans Bellmer. There's so many. How much research did you do in terms of checking out who was there at what time and who actually met? It's a work of fiction based on a true story. I want to know how much of it is true and how much of it is invented.
First, I have to say there was actually a lot more people. And then there were many famous refugees that they helped. Heinrich Mann, Goloman, you know, Alma Mahler. There were many people that we just didn't include. We had to make decisions about who to include. The person who was there the longest was André Breton in the villa. So he was kind of the longest resident of the villa. And the others were coming and going. And whether they all crossed paths as we described them, probably not exactly. Mm-hmm. Many of them did know each other. Like certainly the visual artists knew each other. You know, Hannah Arendt was not famous at the time. She was a close friend of Walter Benjamin's, but they were not there at the same time. But he always talked about her. And he always said that she was the most brilliant woman in Europe. But she was not famous for being the most brilliant woman in Europe yet. You know, it is true that Peggy Guggenheim and Max Ernst met at the villa. That's true. I mean, it would have been great to include even more people, but it's only 7 episodes, so we did what we could. I love Victor Brauner's work, so I included him. Duchamp, of course, we had to include. He didn't actually get out until 42, so his story didn't relate to exactly this story, so we just have him appear in the background, like he's there. It was very important to make the famous people secondary characters because it's not a biopic of any of them, and each of them would deserve their own movie. I mean, one of the ways that the solutions that we came up with was basically that the emergency rescue committee are in the foreground, and the people that they're saving come in and out of the story and are in the background, but we didn't want to feature them too prominently because then it would have been there wouldn't have been enough space, I think, for any of them. So we tried to pick special moments to feature them.
Weltkunst was founded by Walter Bondi, who was a Jewish painter from Prague. He lived in Paris for a long time. Mm-hmm. He came to Berlin with his French wife and baby. And he founded Weltkunst. Mm-hmm. And then in 1932, he left to go to the south of France. So I was...
Oh, to where, do you know?
He went to Sanary-sur-Mer. Mm-hmm. And he actually founded... he became a photographer and photographed in his photography studio, Exilies. He reinvented himself so many times. He was a collector. He was an artist. In the south of France, it's just too beautiful down there.
And, yeah, it's a nightmare in paradise. It really, I mean, yeah. And there's so many stories. Like the people in my story here should have left earlier. You know, they didn't think they'd have to leave Paris. Yeah. They thought they were safe in Paris. It is an incredible story, like small acts of bravery, or let's say large acts of bravery in very small situations that sort of changed the course of history in certain ways. And when you look at the people who were helped by Varian Fry and the impact that they had on mid-century American art and thought and intellectual life and academia. It's just incredible. You know, this is, it's not that many people. It's like about 2,000 people total, a little bit more maybe, but its impact is felt very much in the world that I grew up in, you know, and it you know, I have basically grew up in the world of academia and have always lived in the world of art. So it is, to me, the direct relationship between this story and the version of America that I come from is very clear. If you were to recreate the entire life story of any of these characters, it would be a much more in-depth project. I think for us, it was important to capture something of the essence of each of the historical figures. You know, we had fun with it as well, of course. Like someone like Alex Fehling is certainly, first of all, he's younger than Max Ernst. Max Ernst was 50 at the time, and Alex is like 10 years younger. But he has a kind of, you know, confidence and or arrogance and sort of he's a very special human being and he knows it in a good way. And so he has a kind of attitude that I thought was great for the role. And Jodi May, who plays Peggy, I think does a great job also of being, she says, a real inner enthusiasm. The Chagalls, we had sort of fun with the fact that they spoke Yiddish to each other, because I always think it's funny how everyone thinks of Chagall as being a French artist, but you know, in fact, all of his paintings are about shtetl life, and he was from a shtetl, which in what is now Ukraine, you know. So I loved the idea that he and his wife were speaking to each other in Yiddish. You know, with Hannah Arendt, we had fun with that because she was actually very young in this story, right? And everybody always thinks of her as being like in her 60s, like after the Eichmann trial, the sort of famous movies of her smoking with short hair, but she was 34 at the time. And so Alexa Karolinsky, who wrote Unorthodox with me, plays her, and she'd never acted before. And it was like, but she kind of looks like her. So I convinced her to do it, and I thought she did a great job.
By the way, for everyone, Unorthodox is also so amazing. Such an amazing film.
Well, you know, it's also about, in a way, about flight. It's also kind of an exodus story. It's also about finding a community of artists. So I suppose I repeat myself a lot, but it's, I think my own biography kind of speaks to that, since I've always lived in communities of artists, and I obviously don't live in the place I come from. So, you know, it's interesting to explore things that you know in your own life, but in fictional terrain.
You also portray a beautiful set of Black characters that look surprising to some people.
Only surprising because we're challenging the traditional narrative, but the traditional narrative just doesn't include the stories from the edges of this history. When we started researching what was happening in Marseille at that time, it became clear that because the French had brought over so many people from the various colonies in Central Africa and Northern Africa, some in Asia, to fight the Nazis, after the fall of Paris, those people were released from service. They were still in the country. And there were many people who were involved in the beginnings of the French resistance who were from Africa. At that moment, Marseille was this bottleneck of people just trying to, everybody else from the rest of Europe who'd had to flee was sort of stuck in Marseille. And there was this incredible cultural crossroads that was happening there. It wasn't just people from Eastern Europe and Germany. It was also people from the former colonies who'd been all these from the immigrant armies, Black people. There were, and then there was also the British intelligence, right, who were trying desperately to run third party people as spies, because Brits couldn't really be in France because they were directly fighting the French, right? They were trying to find people, Americans, some Australians. We have a character in the show who is Israeli, or let's say pre-Israeli, a Palestinian Jew, so an early Zionist. So we have, you know, there were all kinds of people who were there, and the British were trying really hard to get resistance movements and cells going. And many of the people who were involved in those efforts were, well, let's say didn't, you know, I think there's this kind of mythology that's been created around the French resistance of like the guy in the beret with a baguette. You know, famously, Josephine Baker was very involved as a spy during a period of French history. But there was a lot of other people too. So we wanted to bring some of the stories from the edges of the narrative, you know, into our series.
You portray Varian Fry, who's a hero, as a gay character, which is historically, I guess, true, but hasn't been shown like this.
To be fair, he hasn't been shown in anything before. but he was a man of his generation, which is to say he was married to a woman, but he slept also with men. And we never use the term gay. Like, I don't put a label on it. But he slept with men, you know. I mean, I guess he loved men and women. Certainly at the time in world history, I don't think there was another version of kind of, let's say it wasn't uncommon to be married to a woman and sleep with men. You know, he wasn't the only story like that. So that was his, you know, there in his archive, you know, there's a lot of evidence of this, but he was there for 14 months. He did have some love affairs that are documented in his diaries and in other people's papers as well. I see this show in many ways as a celebration of the ways in which romance and sex and creativity and art and all these things maybe are even more heightened in a crisis, you know, and provide this, you know, ballast against despair. Yeah, so to me, it feels very accurate. And that was something that was in Julie Arnger's book, in her novel. We changed the specifics of the man that he's in love with and that story. But I thought the story is also about two different kinds. It's like the refugees are running towards a certain kind of freedom in America, a kind of political, well, clearly political freedom. And the Americans are running towards a kind of private freedom that they experience in wartime Europe, right? And this show takes place at this crossroads where the Americans and the Europeans meet. And they're both running towards freedom, but they're running in opposite directions, right? And I think for Mary Jane Gold, she experiences a kind of freedom as a woman that she wouldn't have had in sort of mainstream conservative upper-class America. And Varian experiences a kind of freedom to explore his sexuality in that space. But that doesn't make them less heroic, and it certainly doesn't make them, it doesn't diminish anything about what they did.
It ends with a little bit of a cliffhanger.
Do you think so?
Yes.
Well, I mean, it ends on a slightly hopeful note where you feel that, you know, at least they're going on to start the French Resistance. Yeah. And you hope that at some point, you know, I mean, what happened next is terrible, and we all know what happened next. It is a limited series, like there is no second season, but I do think there are interesting other transatlantic stories like this to be told. For example, you know, what happened in Mexico City after this is very interesting. And I lived in Mexico for a lot of my upbringing, and I was always, I read at one point the day books of Edward Weston, which he wrote in the 30s, so it's a little bit earlier than this story, but he was living in Coyoacán, like among like Frida and Diego and that sort of, the sort of Tino Modotti. And then all of these surrealist artists came into that story, Leonard Carrington, Max Ernst was there for some of it, André Breton was there some of the time, you know, and the impact of European surrealism on Mexican surrealism was also incredible. And so somebody needs to make the story of everything that happened in Coyoacán, because that's also, you know, an amazing kind of transatlantic art historical and colorful, you know, project with a lot of great relationship drama. Someone told me the other day about that he is working on a book about all the American artists who lived in Rome in the 50s. And I was so taken with what he was telling me about that. And he had just incredible stories that then I started fantasizing about doing another transatlantic. You could sort of jump around in history and always call it transatlantic Rome, you know, transatlantic Coyoacán. But anyway, I mean, I think there are lots of stories like this to be told. And I think the intersection of art history with political history is very rich terrain. I think it's something people don't necessarily, you know, typically think of in, you know, sort of the world of television that I'm working in. Something that I find always really rich terrain, like the ways in which artists are kind of manifesting the ideas in contemporary politics and the conflicts of contemporary politics are sort of making that manifest in artwork before it's really felt by the population at large or sort of articulated by the population at large. So I think one of the things that was really moving to me about all of this was that the work, you know, the work in surrealism and the ways in which surrealism served as a tool with which to understand the ununderstandable, right? The things which we could not really process that were happening politically at that time. And when I saw the Venice Biennale last year, I was really struck by, you know, we're going through complicated times politically now, and it is not surprising to me that surrealism is sort of back in force, you know, and the theme of so much of that work was kind of resonating with the same reasons why people were making work like this in the 30s.
True. And it's a time for stranger things.
That's it, yeah. And it's, you know, when you live through things that you can hardly explain to yourself because they're, you know, the truth is stranger than fiction, I think finding a way through it, poetic way through it, is something.
Yeah. Well, I'm very happy that Transatlantic is so successful. It's one of the most watched Netflix series at the moment.
That's always hard to gauge because they don't share the data. But yeah, it got a good start into the world, and we're getting really great feedback from around the world. You know, one of the great privileges of Netflix is that it's so easy to watch, so all over the world. So people find it. You know, we've gotten feedback from people in, you know, Japan and Jordan and Argentina and Mexico, and it's just amazing how different people find their way to the story and see themselves in the story. So it's nice.
What's up next for you? What do you have? Are you already working on a next project?
We're working on a couple of projects. I don't know which one we'll film next. I'm working on one that takes place in the English countryside that's contemporary. We have another German project, which is, I think, very interesting. That's increasingly occupying my mind. You know, I'm a writer and a producer, so I'm writing the work and I'm also producing it with my company. So I have a small group of colleagues who work with me, which is makes it fun to talk about new projects. And we're just, yeah, we just launched this baby into the world. So we're kind of watching it.
If time travel was real, where and to what time would you travel?
I think I would be very happy living in Coyoacan in the 1930s and 40s. I mean, anyone who hasn't had a chance to read the day books of Edward Weston, of the photographer Edward Weston, I really suggest it. There's something, you know, I used to be a photographer. I guess I see myself as now as a photographer who writes. And there's just something about Mexico City when the air was clear that sounds pretty incredible.
What's your most important tool?
I mean, I suppose a laptop is my most important tool, which is kind of a sad one. But I think I personally, as a writer, get a lot of inspiration from reading and looking at other people at other work. You know, so I get a lot from going to the galleries, from going to museums, from going to movies, and from reading. So I'm inspired by the research in my own writing.
If you were an animal, what animal would it be?
I think I would be my own dog because he has a very cozy life.
What's your favorite game?
Game? That's interesting. I did a lot of exquisite cadavers, I'll say, on set. So we got pretty into that. I would say at this point that was definitely up there. Before that, I suppose it would be, I mean, that's going to sound, now I'm revealing myself to be a real old fogey, but I love to play bridge.
What's your favorite color?
Either a sort of deep, slightly brown red, like a kind of burnt sienna verging on red, or olive green.
Do you have a recurring dream?
You know, until I was about 40, I had that dream of arriving for an exam and having done no studying and realizing that I was going to flunk out of college if I failed. It was always a physics exam. And then a miracle happened and I stopped having that. I guess I got old enough or far enough away from college that I no longer had that dream. And since then, I don't think I have a recurring dream.
Do you listen to music when you work?
Yeah. I actually make really elaborate playlists when I'm developing a character and developing a story. And I listen often really obsessively to a certain playlist while I'm building the story in my mind. So yeah, I listen to music. I find my way into the work a lot through music.
For example, with Varian Fry, can you name a song from that playlist?
But there's not always a direct relationship in terms of time period. I think, weirdly, when I was first writing this story, I was listening to a lot of like really sort of anthemic, you know, ambitious 70s rock music. But I actually, what I love about the show is the soundtrack is entirely original, including the songs that are in the party. And it was all composed by a friend of mine from growing up. Mike Ladd is his name. He's a hip hop artist and jazz musician who lives in Paris, but he's American. And And so the, in a way, the whole soundtrack of Transatlantic is like of a piece. And it's, I think it's very special. And we had the chance to record it in Abbey Road Studios because we had all watched the Beatles documentary. And so we were like, let's go record there. So we recorded with the London Symphony Orchestra and it was really fun. And we're releasing it on vinyl.
Is there a topic that you would like to see in Weltkunst, like an entire issue of Weltkunst on one topic?
You know, I'm in, it's going to sound funny. It's like I spent so much of my youth consumed with thinking about photography, and I really take incredible pleasure in looking back at like the history of photography. I love discovering new women photographers in particular who were not recognized, you know, from the past. I mean, there's some obvious ones, but there's more and more, you know. I'm waiting for photography to come back in force because even though we all take pictures with our cell phones, I think there's just something incredible about the finished objects that are photographs that are really made by hand. And yeah, so I would love to see a whole episode. I was about to call it an episode. Whole issue devoted to, you know, women photography, women photographers.
Is there a wisdom you can share with us?
Well, my wisdom, at least work-related wisdom, and I guess, you know, is that the journey is the destination. And it's a very real cliche, but it's very true in what I do. You know, you asked at the very beginning how long it takes to make a project like this. And I would say at a minimum 2 years, right? And it really is the finished product is something you set off into the world, but the daily practice of it, the sort of working together, the collaboration, the going out and, you know, coming up with a crazy project and making it with a whole group of people, you know, that journey is an incredible one. And it's the thing that always makes me want to do it again.
Thank you so much, Anna.
Thank you for having me.
Our podcast, Was macht die Kunst, is produced in partnership with Volkswagen. Volkswagen Group supports different cultural organizations and initiatives in Germany and abroad. Particularly important is to make art and culture accessible to broad audiences. Due to the Volkswagen Group Art for All program, there is free access to Neue Nationalgalerie in Berlin every Thursday from 4 to 8 p.m. The current exhibition shows Gerhard Richter, 100 Works for Berlin.